he's found Jesus, Cynthia thought. It's never Jesus when they grab you like that. It's always Jesus. But of course, that was not what she said.
We have to get out.
Her voice was low, hoarse.
Right now.
She snatched a glance over her shoulder, flicked a look at Cynthia, then seemed to dismiss her entirely as she focused on Steve again. Cynthia had seen this before and wasn't offended by it. When it got to be crunch time, a certain kind of woman could only see the guy. Sometimes it was the way they had been raised. More often, it seemed actually hardwired into their cunning little Barbie doll circuits. Cynthia was getting a better look at her now, in spite of the dark and the blowing dust. An older woman, 30 at least, intelligent looking, not unsexy. Long legs poking out of a short dress that looked somehow gawky, as if the chick inside it wasn't accustomed to wearing dresses. Yet she was far from clumsy, judging from the way she moved with Steve when he moved, as if they were dancing.
"Do you have a car?" she rapped.
"That's no good," Steve said. "The road out of town is blocked."
"Blocked? Blocked how?"
"A couple of house trailers," he said.
"Where?"
"Near the mining company," Cynthia said. "But that's not the only problem. There are a lot of dead people."
"Tell me about it," she said, and laughed shrilly. "Collie's gone nuts. I saw him kill half a dozen myself. He drove after them in his cruiser and shot them down in the street, like they were cattle, and Main Street was the killing floor."
She was still holding on to Steve, shaking him as she spoke, as if scolding him, but her eyes were everywhere.
"We have to get off the street. If he catches us, come in here. It's safe. I've been in here since yesterday forenoon."
He came in once.
"I hid under the desk in the office. I thought he'd follow the smell of my perfume and find me. Come around the desk and find me. But he didn't. Maybe he had a stuffy nose."
She began to laugh hysterically, then abruptly slapped her own face to make herself stop. It was funny in a shocking way. The sort of thing the characters in old Warner Brothers cartoons sometimes did. Cynthia shook her head. "Not the laundromat. The movie theater. There are other people there."
"I saw his shadow," the woman said.
She was still holding Steve by the shoulders, and her face was still turned confidentially up to his, as if she thought he was Humphrey Bogart and she was Ingrid Bergman, and there was a soft filter on the camera.
"I saw his shadow. It fell across the desk, and I was sure, but he didn't. And I think we'll be safe in the office while we think about what to do next."
Cynthia reached out, took the woman's chin in her hand, and turned it toward her.
"What are you doing?" the dark-haired woman asked angrily. "Just what in the hell do you think you're doing?"
"Getting your attention, I hope." Cynthia let go of the woman's face and be damned if she didn't immediately turn back to Steve, every bit as brainless as a flower turning on its stalk to follow the sun, and resume her speed rap.
"I was under the desk, and we have to, listen, we have to..."
Cynthia reached out again, grasped the woman's lower face again, turned it back in her direction again.
"Hun, read my lips. The theater. There are other people there."
The woman looked at her, frowning as if she were trying to get the sense of this. Then she looked past Cynthia's shoulder at the chain-hung marquee of the American West.
"The old movie show?"
"Yes."
"Are you sure? I tried the door last night after it got dark. It's locked."
"We're supposed to go around to the back," Steve said. "I have a friend. That's where he told me to go."
"How'd he do that?" the dark-haired woman asked suspiciously.
But when Steve started walking in that direction, she went along. Cynthia fell in next to her, walking on the outside.
"How could he do that?"
"Cellular phone," Steve said. "They don't work very well around here as a rule," the dark-haired woman said. "Too many mineral deposits."
They walked under the theater's marquee, a tumbleweed caught in an angle between the glassed-in ticket booth and the left-hand door rattled like a maraca, and stopped on the far side. "There's the alley," Cynthia said. She started forward, but the woman stayed where she was, frowning from Steve to Cynthia, and then back to Steve again. "What friend? What other people?" she asked. "How did they get here? How come that fuck Collie didn't kill them?" "Let's save all that for later." Steve took her arm. She resisted his tug, and when she spoke this time, there was a catch in her voice. "You're taking me to him, aren't you?" "Lady, we don't even know who you're talking about," Cynthia said. "Just for Christ's sake, will you come on?"
"I hear a motor," Steve said. His head was cocked to one side. "Coming from the south, I think. Coming in this direction, for sure."
The woman's eyes widened.
"Him," she whispered. "Him."
She looked over her shoulder, as if longing for the safety of the laundromat, and then made her decision and bolted down the alley. By the time they got to the board fence running along the back of the theater, Cynthia and Steve were hurrying just to keep up. 4.
"Are you sure?"
the woman began, and then a flashlight flicked, once, from farther down the building. They were in single file, Steve between the women, the one from the laundromat ahead of him. He took her hand, very cold, in his right and reached back to Cynthia's, marginally warmer, with his left. The dark-haired woman led them slowly down the path. The flashlight blinked on again, this time pointed down at two stacked crates. "Climb up and get on in here," a voice whispered. It was one Steve was delighted to hear.
"Boss?"
"You bet." Marinville sounded as if he might be smiling. "Love the coverall look. It's so masculine. Get on in here, Steve."
"There are three of us. The more the merrier."
The dark-haired woman hiked her skirt in order to get up on the crates, and Steve could see the boss helping himself to an eyeful. Even the apocalypse couldn't change some things, apparently. Steve helped Cynthia up next, then followed. He turned around, slid partway in, then reached down and pushed the top crate off the one underneath. He didn't know if it would be enough to fool the guy the dark-haired woman was so afraid of if he came back here sniffing around, but it was better than nothing. He slid into the room, a wino hideout if he had ever seen one, then grabbed the boss and hugged him. Marinville laughed, sounding both surprised and pleased.
"Just no tongue, Steve, I insist."
Steve held him by the shoulders, grinning. "I thought you were dead. We found your scoot buried in the sand."
"You found it?"
Now Marinville sounded delighted.
"Son of a bitch!
What happened to your face?" Marinville held the lens of the flashlight under his chin, turning his lumpy, discolored face into something out of a horror movie. His nose looked like roadkill. His grin, although cheerful, made matters even worse.
"If I made a speech to Pen America looking like this, do you think the assholes would finally listen?"
"Man," Cynthia said, awed, "someone put a real hurt on you."
"Entragian," Marinville said gravely. "Have you met him?"
"No," Steve said, "and judging from what I've heard and seen so far, I don't want to." The bathroom door swung open, squalling on its hinges, and a kid stood there. Short hair, pale face, blood-smeared Cleveland Indians T-shirt. He had a flashlight in one hand, and he moved it quickly, picking out the newcomers' faces one at a time. Things came together in Steve's mind as neatly as jigsaw puzzle pieces. He supposed the kid's shirt was the key connection.
"Are you Steve?" the boy asked.
Steve nodded. "That's me, Steve Ames. This is Cynthia Smith, and you're my phone pal." The boy smiled wanly at that.
"That was good timing, David. You'll probably never know how good. It's nice to meet you. David Carver, isn't it?"
He stepped forward and shook the boy's free hand, enjoying the look of surprise on his face. God knew the kid had surprised him, coming through on the phone that way. How do you know my last name? Cynthia took David's hand when Steve let it go. She shook it once, firmly. We found your Humvee or Winnebago or whatever it is. Steve there checked out your baseball cards. Be honest, Steve said to David. Do you think Cleveland's ever going to win the World Series? I don't care, just as long as I'm around to see them play another game, David said with a trace of a smile. Cynthia turned toward the woman from the laundromat, the one they might have shot if they'd had guns. And this is? Audrey Weiler, the dark-haired woman said. I'm a consulting geologist for Diablo Mining. At least, I was. She scanned the ladies' room with large, dazed eyes, taking in the carton of liquor bottles, the bins of beer cans, the fabulous fish swimming on one dirty, tiled wall. Right now, I don't know what I am. What I feel like is meatloaf 3 days left over. She turned, little by little, toward Marinville as she spoke, much as she had turned toward Steve outside the laundromat, and took up her original scripture. We've got to get out of town. Your pal here says the road out is blocked, but I know another one. It goes from the staging area down at the bottom of the embankment out to Highway 50. It's a mess, but there are ATVs in the motor pool, half a dozen of them. I'm sure your knowledge will come in very handy, but I think we ought to pass that part by for the time being, Marinville said. He spoke in a professionally soothing voice, one Steve recognized right away. It was how the boss talked to the women, it was invariably women, usually in their 50s or early 60s, who set up his literary lectures, what he called his cultural bombing runs. We had better talk things over a little first. Come on into the theater. There's quite a setup there. I think you'll be amazed. What are you, stupid? She asked. We don't need to talk things over. We need to get out of here. She looked around at them. You don't seem to grasp what has happened here. This man, Collie Antragian... Marinville raised his flashlight and shone it full into his face for a moment, letting her get a good look. I've met the man, as you can see, and I grasp plenty. Come on out front, Ms. Weiler, and we'll talk. I see you're impatient with that idea, but it's for the best. The carpenters have a saying, measure twice, cut once. It's a good saying. All right? She gave him a reluctant look, but when he started toward the door, she followed. So did Steve and Cynthia. Outside, the wind screamed around the theater, making it groan in its deepest joints. 5. The dark shape of a car, one with light bars on the roof, rolled slowly north through the wind-screaming dark, away from the rampart that marked China Pit at the south end of Desperation. It rolled with its lights off. The thing behind the wheel saw quite well in the dark, even when that darkness was stuffed with flying grit. The car passed the bodega at the town's south end. The fallen sign reading Mexican Foods was now mostly covered by blowing sand. All that still showed in the weak glow of the porch bulb was Can Foo. The cruiser drove slowly on up the street to the municipal building, turned into the lot, and parked where it had before. Behind the wheel, the large, slumped figure wearing the Sam Brown belt with the badge on the cross strap was singing an old song in a tuneless, droning voice. And we'll go dancing, baby, then you'll see how the magic's in the music and the music's in me. The creature in the driver's seat killed the Caprice's engine and then just sat there, head down, fingers tapping at the wheel. A buzzard flapped out of the flying dirt, made a last-minute course adjustment as the wind gusted, then landed on the hood of the cruiser. A second followed, and a third. This latest arrival squalled at his mates, then squirted a thick stream of guano onto the car's hood. They lined up, looking in through the dirty windshield. Jews, the driver said, must die. And Catholics. Mormons, too. Tack!
The door opened. One foot swung out, then another. The figure in the Sam Brown belt stood up, slammed the door shut. It held its new hat under its arm for the time being. In its other hand, it held the shotgun the woman, Mary, had grabbed off the desk. It walked around to the front door. Here, flanking the steps, were two coyotes. They whined uneasily and shrank down on their haunches, grinning sycophantic doggy grins at the approaching figure, which passed them with no acknowledgement at all. It reached for the door, and then its hand froze. The door was ajar. A vagary of wind had sucked it most of the way shut, but not completely. "What the fuck?" it muttered, and opened the door. It went upstairs fast, first putting the hat on, jamming it down hard. It didn't fit so well now. And then shifting the shotgun to both hands. A coyote lay dead at the top of the stairs. The door which led into the holding area was also standing open. The thing with the shotgun in its hand stepped in, knowing already what it would see, but the knowing did not stop the angry roar which came out of its chest. Outside, at the foot of the steps, the coyotes whined and cringed and squirted urine. On the police cruiser, the buzzards also heard the cry of the thing upstairs and fluttered their wings uneasily, almost lifting off and then settling back, darting their heads restlessly at each other, as if to peck. In the holding area, all the cells which had been occupied were now standing open and empty. "That boy," the figure in the doorway whispered. Its hands were white on the stock of the shotgun. "That nasty little drug user." It stood there a moment longer, then stepped slowly into the room. Its eyes shifted back and forth in its expressionless face. Its hat, a smoky style with a flat brim, was slowly rising again as the thing's hair pushed it up. It had a great deal more hair than the hat's previous owner. The woman Collie Antragian had taken from the detention area and down the stairs had been 5'6", 130 pounds. This thing looked like that woman's very big sister, 6'3", broad-shouldered, probably 200 pounds. It was wearing a coverall it had taken from the supply shed before driving back out of what the mining company called Rattlesnake Number 2, and the townspeople had for over 100 years called the China Pit. The coverall was a bit tight in the breast and the hip, but still better than this body's old clothes. They were as useless to it now as Ellen Carver's old concerns and desires. As for Antragian, it had his belt, badge, and hat. It wore his pistol on her hip. Of course it did. After all, Ellen Carver was the only law west of the Pecos now. It was her job, and God help anyone who tried to keep her from doing a good one. Her former son, for instance. From the breast pocket of the coverall, it took a small piece of sculpture, a spider carved from gray stone. It canted drunkenly to the left on Ellen's palm. One of its legs on that side was broken off. But that in no way dissipated its ugliness or its malevolence. Pitted stone eyes, purple with iron that had been volcano-cooked millennia ago, bulged from above its mandible, which gaped to show a tongue that was not a tongue, but the grinning head of a tiny coyote. On the spider's back was a shape which vaguely resembled a country fiddle. "Tack," the creature standing by the desk said. Its face was slack and doughy, a cruel parody of the face of the woman who, 10 hours before, had been reading her daughter a Curious George book and sharing a cup of cocoa with her. Yet the eyes in that face were alive and aware and venomous, hideously like the eyes of the thing resting on her palm. Now she took it in her other hand and raised it over her head into the light of the hanging glass globe over the desk. "Tak Awan!
Tak Allah, me him, and toe, and toe.
Recluse spiders came hurrying toward it from the darkness of the stairwell, from cracks in the baseboard, from the dark corners of the empty cells. They gathered around it in a circle. Slowly, it lowered the stone spider to the desk. Tak, it cried softly. Mihem, ento. A ripple went through the attentive circle of spiders. There were maybe 50 in all, most no bigger than plump raisins. Then the circle broke up, streaming toward the door in two lines. The thing that had been Ellen Carver, before Collie and Trajan took her down into the china pit, stood watching them go. Then it put the carving back into its pocket. Jews must die, it told the empty room. Catholics must die. Mormons must die. Grateful Dead fans must die. It paused. Little Pray Boys must also die. It raised Ellen Carver's hands and began tapping Ellen Carver's fingers meditatively against Ellen Carver's collarbones. Part 3. The American West, Legendary Shadows. Chapter 1. 1.
Holy shit, Steve said. This is amazing.
Fucking weird is what it is, Cynthia replied, then looked around to see if she had offended the old man. Billingsley was nowhere in sight.
Young lady, Johnny said, weird is the mosh pit, the only invention for which your generation can so far take credit. This is not weird. This is rather nice, in fact.
Weird, Cynthia repeated, but she was smiling. Johnny guessed that the American West had been built in the decade following World War II, when movie theaters were no longer the overblown Xanadus they had been in the 20s and 30s, but long before mauling and multiplexing turned them into Dolby-equipped shoeboxes. Billingsley had turned on the pin spots above the screen and those in what once would have been called the orchestra pit, and Johnny had no trouble seeing the place. The auditorium was big but bland. There were vaguely Art Deco electric wall sconces, but no other grace notes. Most of the seats were still in place, but the red plush was faded and threadbare and smelled powerfully of mildew. The screen was a huge white rectangle upon which Rock Hudson had once clinched with Doris Day, across which Charlton Heston had once matched chariots with Stephen Boyd. It had to be at least 40 feet long and 20 feet high. From where Johnny stood, it looked the size of a drive-in screen. There was a stage area in front of the screen, a kind of architectural holdover, Johnny assumed, since vaudeville must have been dead by the time this place was built. Had it ever been used? He supposed so, for political speeches or high school graduations, maybe for the final round of the Cowshit County Spelling Bee. Whatever purposes it had served in the past, surely none of the people who had attended those quaint country ceremonies could have predicted this stage's final function. He glanced around, a little worried about Billingsley now, and saw the old man coming down the short, narrow corridor which led from the bathrooms to the backstage area where the rest of them were clustered.
Old fella's got a bottle stashed. He went back for a quick snort, that's all, Johnny thought.
But he couldn't smell fresh booze on the old guy when he brushed past, and that was a smell he never missed now that he had quit drinking himself. They followed Billingsley out onto the stage, the group of people Johnny was coming to think of, and not entirely without affection, as the Collie and Trajan Survival Society, their feet clumping and echoing, their shadows long and pallid in the orchestra's sidelights. Billingsley had turned these on from a box in the electrical closet by the stage left entrance. Above the tatty red plush seats, the weak light petered out in a hurry, and there was only darkness ascending to some unseen height. Above that, and on all sides as well,
The desert wind howled. It was a sound that cooled Johnny's blood, but he could not deny the fact that there was also something strangely attractive about it, although what that attraction might be, he didn't know. Oh, don't lie. You know. Billingsley and his friends knew as well. That's why they came here. God made you to hear that sound, and a room like this is a natural amplifier for it. You can hear it even better when you sit in front of the screen with your old pals, throwing legendary shadows and drinking to the past. That sound says quitting is okay, that quitting is in fact the only choice that makes any sense. That sound is about the lure of emptiness and the pleasures of zero. In the middle of the dusty stage, and in front of the curtainless screen, was a living room. Easy chairs, sofas, standing lamps, a coffee table, even a TV. The furniture stood on a big piece of carpet. It was a little like a display in the home living section of a department store, but what Johnny kept coming back to was the idea that if Eugene Ionesco had ever written an episode of The Twilight Zone, the set would probably have looked a lot like this. Dominating the decor was a fumed oak bar. Johnny ran a hand over it as Billingsley snapped on the standing lamps, one after the other. The electrical cords, Johnny saw, ran through small slits in the lower part of the screen. The edges of these rips had then been mended with electrical tape to keep them from widening. Billingsley nodded at the bar. That come from the old Circle Ranch. Part of the Clayton Loving auction it was. Buzz Hansen and me teamed together and knocked it down for $17. Can you believe it? Frankly, no, Johnny said, trying to imagine what an item like this might go for in one of those precious little shops down in Soho. He opened the double doors and saw the bar was fully stocked. Good stuff, too. Not primo, but good. He closed the doors again in a hurry. The bottles inside called to him in a way the bottle of Beam he had taken out of the Owls had not. Ralph Carver sat down in a wing chair and looked out over the empty seats with the dazed hopefulness of a man who dares to think he may be dreaming after all. David went over to the television. Do you get anything on this? Oh, I see. He had spotted the VCR underneath. He squatted down to look at the cassette stacked on top of it. Son, Billingsley began, then gave up. David shuffled through the boxes quickly. Sex-starved co-eds, dirty debutantes, cockpit honeys, part three, and then put them back. You guys watch these? Billingsley shrugged. He looked both tired and embarrassed. We're too old to rodeo, son. Someday maybe you'll understand. Hey, it's your business, David said, standing up. I was just asking. Steve, look at this, Cynthia said. She stepped back, raised her arms over her head, crossed them at the wrists, and wiggled them. A huge dark shape flapped lazily on the screen, which was dingy with several decades worth of accumulated dust. A crow. Not bad, huh? He grinned, stepped next to her, and placed his hands together out in front of him with one finger jutting down. An elephant! Cynthia laughed. Too cool! David laughed with her. It was an easy sound, cheerful and free. His father turned his head toward it and smiled himself. Not bad for a kid from Lubbock, Cynthia said. Better watch that, unless you want me to start calling you Cookie again. She stuck her tongue out, eyes closed, fingers twiddling in her ears, reminding Johnny so strongly of Terry that he laughed out loud. The sound startled, almost frightened him. He supposed that somewhere between Entragian and Sundown, he had pretty much decided he would never laugh again. Not at the funny stuff, anyway. Mary Jackson, who had been walking around the onstage living room and looking at everything, now glanced up at Steve's elephant. I can make the New York City skyline, she announced. My ass, Cynthia said, although she looked intrigued by the concept. Let's see, David said. He was looking up at the screen as expectantly as a kid waiting for the start of the newest Ace Ventura movie. Okay, Mary said, and raised her hands with the fingers pointing up. Now, let's see. Give me a second. I learned this in summer camp, and that was a long time ago. What the fuck are you people doing?
The strident voice startled Johnny badly, and he wasn't the only one. Mary gave a little scream. The city skyline, which had begun to form on the old movie screen, went out of focus and disappeared. Audrey Weiler was standing halfway between the stage-left entrance and the living room grouping, her face pale, her eyes wide and hot. Her shadow loomed on the screen behind her, making its own image, all unknown to its creator, Batman's cloak.
"You guys are insane as he is. You must be. He's out there somewhere looking for us. Right now. Don't you remember the car you heard, Steve? That was him coming back. But you stand here, with the lights on, playing party games."
"The lights wouldn't show from the outside, even if we had all of them on," Billingsley said. He was looking at Audrey in a way that was both thoughtful and intense. As if, Johnny thought, he had the idea he had seen her somewhere before, possibly in Dirty Debutantes. "It's a movie theater, remember? Pretty much soundproof and lightproof. That's what we liked about it, my gang."
"But he'll come looking, and if he looks long enough and hard enough, he'll find us. When you're in desperation, there aren't that many places to hide."
"Let him," Ralph Carver said hollowly and raised the Ruger 44. "He killed my little girl and took my wife away. I saw what he's like as much as you did, lady, so let him come. I got some express mail for him."
Audrey looked at him uncertainly for a moment. He looked back at her with dead eyes. She glanced at Mary, found nothing there to interest her, and looked at Billingsley again. "He could sneak up. A place like this must have half a dozen ways in, maybe more."
"Yep, and everyone locked except for the ladies' room window," Billingsley said. "I went back there just now and set up a line of beer bottles on the window ledge inside. If he opens the window, it'll swing in, hit the bottles, knock 'em over, smash 'em on the floor. We'll hear him, ma'am, and when he walks out here, we'll fill him so full of lead you could cut him up and use him for sinkers."
He was looking at her closely as he uttered this grandiosity, eyes alternating between her face, which was okay, and her legs, which were, in John Edward Marinville's humble opinion, pretty fucking spectacular. She continued to look at Billingsley as if she had never seen a bigger fool. "Ever hear of keys, old-timer? The cops have keys to all the businesses in these little towns."
"To the open ones, that's so," Billingsley replied quietly. "But the American West hasn't been open for a long time. The doors ain't just locked, they're boarded shut. The kids used the fire escape to get in up front, but that ended last March when it fell down. Nope, I reckon we're as safe here as anywhere."
"Probably safer than out on the street," Johnny said.
Audrey turned to him, hands on her hips. "Well, what do you intend to do? Stay here and amuse yourselves by making shadow animals on the goddamn movie screen?"
"Take it easy," Steve said.
"You take it easy," she almost snarled. "I want to get out of here."
"We all do, but this isn't the time," Johnny said.
He looked around at the others. "Does anyone disagree?"
"It'd be insanity to go out there in the dark," Mary said. "The wind's got to be blowing 50 miles an hour, and with the sand flying the way it is, he'd be apt to pick us off one by one."
"What do you think's going to change tomorrow when the storm ends and the sun comes out?" Audrey asked. It was Johnny she was asking, not Mary.
"I think that friend Entragian may be dead by the time the storm ends," he said, "if he's not already."
Ralph looked over and nodded. David hunkered by the TV, hands loosely clasped between his knees, looking at Johnny with deep concentration.
"Why?" Audrey asked.
"How?"
"You haven't seen him?" Mary asked her.
"Of course I have. Just not today. Today I only heard him driving around, walking around, and talking to himself. I haven't actually seen him since yesterday."
"Is there anything radioactive around here, ma'am?" Ralph asked Audrey. "Was it ever..." Like some sort of dumping ground for nuclear waste or maybe old weapons, missile warheads or something? Because the cop looked like he was falling apart.
I don't think it was radiation sickness, Mary said. I've seen pictures of that and...
Whoa, Johnny said, raising his hands. I want to make a suggestion. I think we should sit down and talk this out, okay? It'll pass the time, if nothing else, and an idea of what we should do next may come out of it. He looked at Audrey, gave her his most winning smile, and was delighted to see her relax a little, if not exactly melt. Maybe not all of the old charm had departed after all. At the very least, it will be more constructive than making shadows on the movie screen. His smile faded a little, and he turned to look at them. Audrey standing on the edge of the rug in her gawky, sexy dress. David squatting by the TV. Steve and Cynthia now sitting on the arms of an overstuffed easy chair that looked like it might also have come from the old Circle Ranch. Mary standing by the screen and looking schoolteacherly with her arms folded under her breasts. Tom Billingsley now inspecting the open upper cabinet of the bar with his hands tightly clasped behind his back. Ralph in the wing chair at the edge of the light with his left eye now puffed almost completely shut. The Collie and Trajan Survival Society, all present and accounted for. What a crew, Johnny thought. Manhattan Transfer in the desert. There's another reason we have to talk, he said. He glanced at their shadows bobbing on the curtainless movie screen. For a moment they all looked to him like the shadows of giant birds. He thought of Entragian telling him buzzards farted. They were the only birds that did. Of Entragian saying, oh shit, we're all beyond why, you know that. Johnny thought that might well be the scariest thing anyone had said to him in his whole life, mostly because it rang true. Johnny nodded slowly, as if in agreement with some interior speaker, then went on. I've seen some extraordinary things in my life, but I've never had what I could in any way characterize as a supernatural experience. Until, maybe, today. And what scares me the most about it is that the experience may be ongoing. I don't know. All I can say for sure is that things have happened to me in the last few hours that I can't explain. What are you talking about? Audrey sounded close to tears. Isn't what's happening bad enough without turning it into some kind of a campfire story? Yes, Johnny said, speaking in a low, compassionate voice that he hardly recognized. But that doesn't change things. I listen and talk better when I'm not starving to death, Mary remarked. I don't suppose there's anything to eat in this place, is there? Tom Billingsley shuffled his feet and looked embarrassed.
Well, no, not a whole lot, ma'am. Mostly we came here in the evenings to drink and talk over the old days.
She sighed. That's what I thought. He pointed vaguely across toward the stage right entrance.
Marty Ives brought in a little bag of something a couple of nights ago. Probably sardines. Marty loves sardines and crackers.
Yuck, Mary said, but she looked interested almost in spite of herself. Johnny supposed that in another 2 or 3 hours even anchovies would look good to her.
I'll take a peek. Maybe he brought in something else, Billingsley said. He didn't sound hopeful.
David got up. I'll do it if you want.
Billingsley shrugged. He was looking at Audrey again and seemed to have lost interest in Marty Ives's sardines.
There's a light switch to the left just as you get off stage. Straight ahead you'll see some shelves. Anything people brought to eat, they most generally put it on those. You might find some Oreos, too.
You guys might have drunk a tad too much, but at least you kept the minimum nutrition needs in mind, Johnny said. I like that.
The vet gave him a glance, shrugged, and went back to Audrey Weiler's legs. She seemed not to notice his interest in them, or to care. David started across the stage, then went back and picked up the .45. He glanced at his father, but Ralph was staring vacantly out into the house again, at red plush seats, which faded back into the gloom. The boy put the gun carefully into the pocket of his jeans so that only the handle stuck out, then started off stage. As he passed Billingsley, he said, "Is there running water?"
"This is the desert, son. When a building goes vacant, they turn the water off." "Crud. I've still got soap all over me. It itches."
He left them, crossed the stage, and leaned into the opening over there. A moment later, the light came on. Johnny relaxed slightly, only realizing as he did that part of his mind had expected something to jump the boy, and realized that Billingsley was looking at him.
"What that kid did back there, the way he got out of that cell, that was impossible," Billingsley said.
"Then we must still be back there, locked up," Johnny said. He thought he sounded all right, pretty much like himself, but what the old veterinarian was saying had already occurred to him. Even a phrase to describe it had occurred to him. Unobtrusive miracles. He would have written it down in his notebook if he hadn't dropped it beside Highway 50. "Is that what you think?" "No, we're here, and we saw him do what he did," Billingsley said. "Greased himself up with soap and squeezed out through the bars like a watermelon seed. Looked like it made sense, didn't it? But I tell you, friend, not even Houdini could have done it that way. Because of the head. He should have stuck at the head, but he didn't."
He looked them over, one by one, finishing with Ralph. Ralph was looking at Billingsley now instead of at the seats, but Johnny wasn't sure he understood what the old guy was saying. And maybe that was for the best.
"What are you driving at?" Mary asked.
"I'm not sure," Billingsley replied. "But I think we'd do well to kind of gather round, young Master Carver."
He hesitated, then added, "The old-timers say that any campfire does on a cold night."
2. It picked the dead coyote up and examined it.
"Soma dies, Numa departs, only Sarx remains," it said in a voice that was a paradox, both sonorous and entirely without tone. "So it has always been, so it shall always be. Life sucks, then you die."
It carried the animal downstairs, paws and shattered head dangling, body swaying like a bloody fur stole. The creature holding it stood for a moment inside the main doors of the municipal building, looking out into the blowy dark, listening to the wind.
"So cassette!" it exclaimed, then turned away and took the animal into the town office.
It looked at the coat hooks to the right of the door and saw immediately that the girl, Pie, to her brother, had been taken down and wrapped in a drape. Its pale face twisted in anger as it looked at the child's covered form.
"Took her down," it told the dead coyote in its arms. "Rotten boy, took her down, stupid troublemaking boy."
"Yes, feckless boy, rude boy, foolish boy."
In some ways that last was the best, wasn't it? The truest. Foolish prey boy trying to make at least some part of it come right, as if any part of a thing like this ever could be, as if death were an obscenity that could be scrubbed off life's wall by a strong arm, as if the closed book could be reopened and read again with a different ending. Yet its anger was twisted through with fear, like a yellow stitch through red cloth, because the boy was not giving up, and so the rest of them were not giving up. They should not have dared to run from Entragian, her, it, them. Even if their cell doors had been standing wide open, yet they had. Because of the boy, the wretched, overblown, prideful, praying boy, who had had the insolence to take down his little cunt of a sister and try to give her something approximating a decent burial, a kind of dull warmth on its fingers and palms. It looked down and saw that it had plunged Ellen's hands into the coyote's belly all the way to the wrists. It had intended to hang the coyote on one of the hooks, simply because that was what it had done with some of the others. But now another idea occurred. It carried the coyote across to the green bundle on the floor, knelt, and pulled the drape open. It looked down with a silent, snarling mouth at the dead girl who had grown inside this present body. That he should have covered her. It pulled Ellen's hands, now dressed in lukewarm blood gloves, out of the coyote, and laid the animal down on top of Kirsten. It opened the coyote's jaws and placed them around the child's neck. There was something both grisly and fantastic about this tableau de la mort. It was like a woodcut illustration from a black fairy tale. "Tack," it whispered, and grinned. Ellen Carver's lower lip split open when it did. Blood ran down her chin in an unnoticed rill. The rotten, presumptuous little boy would probably never view this revision of his revision, but how nice it was to imagine his reaction to it if he did. If he saw how little his efforts had come to, how easily respect could be snatched back, how naturally zero reasserted itself in the artificially concocted integers of men. It pulled the drape up to the coyote's neck. Now the child and the beast almost seemed to be lovers. How it wished the boy were here. The father, too, but especially the boy. Because it was the boy who so badly needed instruction. It was the boy who was the dangerous one. There was scuttering from behind it, a sound too low to be heard, but it heard it anyway. It pivoted on Ellen's knees and saw the recluse spiders returning. They came through the town office door, turned left, then streamed up the wall, over posters announcing forthcoming town business and soliciting volunteers for this fall's Pioneer Days extravaganza. Above the one announcing an informational meeting at which Desperation Mining Corporation officials would discuss the resumption of copper mining at the so-called China Pit, the spiders reformed their circle. The tall woman in the coverall and the Sam Brown belt got up and approached them. The circle on the wall trembled as if expressing fear or ecstasy or perhaps both. The woman put bloody hands together, then opened them to the wall, palms out. "Allah?" The circle dissolved. The spider scurried into a new shape, moving with the precision of a drill team putting on a halftime show. T, they made, then broke up, scurried, and made an H. An E followed. An A. Another T. Another E. It waved them off while they were still scrambling around up there, deciding how to fall in and make an R. "Ento," it said. "Ras." The spiders gave up on their R and resumed their faintly trembling circle. "Ten A?" it asked after a moment, and the spiders formed a new figure. It was a circle, the shape of the inny. The woman with Ellen Carver's fingerprints looked at it for several moments, tapping Ellen's fingers against Ellen's collarbones, then waved Ellen's hand at the wall. The figure broke up. The spiders began to stream down to the floor. It walked back out into the hall, not looking at the spiders streaming about its feet. The spiders would be available if it needed them, and that was all that mattered. It stood at the double doors, once more looking out into the night. It couldn't see the old movie house, but that was all right. It knew where the American West was, about an eighth of a mile north of here, just past the town's only intersection. And, thanks to the Fiddlebacks, she now knew where they were as well. Where he was. The shitting little prey boy. 3. Johnny Merrinville told his story again, all of it this time. For the first time in a good many years, he tried to keep it short. There were critics all over America who would have applauded, partly in disbelief. He told them about stopping to take a leak, and how Entragian had planted the pot in his saddlebag while he was doing it. He told them about the coyotes, the one Entragian had seemed to talk to, and the others, posted along the road at intervals like a weird honor guard, and about how the big cop had beaten him up. He recounted the murder of Billy Rancourt, and then, with no appreciable change in his voice, about how the buzzard had attacked him, seemingly at Collie Entragian's command. There was an expression of frank disbelief on Audrey Wyler's face at this, but Johnny saw Steve and the skinny little girl he'd picked up somewhere along the way exchange a look of sick understanding. Johnny didn't glance around to see how the others were taking it, but instead looked down at his hands on his knees, concentrating as he did when he was trying to work through a tough patch of composition. He wanted me to suck his cock. I think that was supposed to start me gibbering and begging for mercy, but I didn't find the idea as shocking as Entragian maybe expected. Cocksucking's a pretty standard sexual demand in situations where authorities exceeded its normal bounds and restrictions, but it's not what it looks like. On the surface, rape is about dominance and aggression. Underneath, though, it's about fear-driven anger. "Thank you, Dr. Ruth," Audrey said. "Next, we will be discussing the imprudence." Johnny looked at her without rancor. "I did a novel on the subject of homosexual rape, Augustus. Not a big critical success, but I talked to a lot of people and got the basics down pretty well, I think. The point is, he made me mad instead of scaring me. By then I'd decided I didn't have a lot to lose anyway. I told him that I'd take his cock all right, but once it was in my mouth, I'd bite it off. Then, he thought harder than he had in at least 10 years, nodding to himself as he did. Then I threw one of his own nonsense words back at him. At least it seemed like nonsense to me, or something in a made-up language. It had a guttural quality. "Was it tack?" Mary asked. Johnny nodded, and it didn't seem to be nonsense to the coyotes, or to Entragian either. When I said it, he kind of recoiled, and that's when he called the buzzard bombing strike down on me. "I don't believe that happened," Audrey said. "I guess you're a famous writer or something, and you've got the look of a guy who isn't used to having doubt cast, so to speak, but I just don't believe it." "It's what happened, though," he said. "You didn't see anything like that? Strange, aggressive animal behavior?" "I was hiding in the town laundromat," she said. "I mean, hello? Are we talking the same language here? But, listen, you want to talk about strange and aggressive animal behavior?" Audrey asked. She leaned forward, eyes bright and fixed on Marinville's. "That's Collie you're talking about. Collie as he is now. He killed everyone he saw, everyone who crossed his path. Isn't that enough for you? Do we have to have trained buzzards as well?" "What about spiders?" Steve asked. He and the skinny girl were in the chair instead of sitting on the arms now, and Steve had his arm around her shoulders. "What about them? Did you see any spiders kind of, well, flocking together? Like birds of a feather?" She was favoring him with a gaze that said, "Caution, lunatic at work." "Well, no. Wrong word. Traveling together. In packs. Like wolves. Or coyotes." She shook her head. "What about snakes?" "Haven't seen any of them, either. Or coyotes in town. Not even a dog riding a bike and wearing a party hat. This is all news to me." David came back onto the stage with a brown bag in his hands, the kind that convenience store clerks put small purchases in. Twinkies and Slim Jims, cartons of milk, single cans of beer. He also had a box of Ritz crackers under his arm. "Found some stuff," he said. "Uh-huh," Steve said, eyeing the box and the little bag. "That should certainly take care of hunger in America. What does it come to, Davy? One sardine and two crackers apiece, do you think?"
"Actually, there's quite a lot," David said. "More than you'd think."
He paused, looking at them thoughtfully and a little anxiously. "Would anybody mind if I said a prayer before I hand this stuff around?"
"Like grace?" Cynthia asked.
"Grace, yeah."
"It works for me," Johnny said. "I think we can use all the grace we can lay our hands on."
"Amen," Steve said.
David put the bag and the box of crackers down between his sneakers. Then he closed his eyes and put his hands together again before his face, finger to finger. Johnny was struck by the kid's lack of pretension. There was a simplicity about the gesture that had been honed by use into beauty. "God, please bless this food we are about to eat," David began.
"Yeah, what there is of it," Cynthia said, and immediately looked sorry that she had spoken. David didn't seem to mind, though. Might not have even heard her.
"Bless our fellowship, take care of us, and deliver us from evil. Please take care of my mom, too, if that's your will." He paused, then said in a lower voice, "It's probably not, but please, if it's your will. Jesus' sake, amen." He opened his eyes again. Johnny was moved. The kid's little prayer had touched him in the very place Entragian had tried and failed to reach.
Sure it did, because he believes it.
In his own humble way, this kid makes Pope John Paul and his fancy clothes and Las Vegas hat look like an Easter and Christmas Christian. David bent over and picked up the stuff he'd found, seeming as cheerful as a soup kitchen tycoon presiding over Thanksgiving dinner as he rummaged in the bag. "Here, Mary." He took out a can of Blue Fjord fancy sardines and handed it to her. "Keys on the bottom."
"Thank you, David."
He grinned. "Thank Mr. Billingsley's friend. It's his food, not mine." He handed her the crackers. "Pass 'em on."
"Take what you need and leave the rest," Johnny said expansively. "That's what us friends of the circle say. Right, Tom?"
The veterinarian gave him a watery gaze and didn't reply. David gave a can of sardines to Steve and another to Cynthia.
"Oh, no, honey, that's okay," Cynthia said, trying to give hers back. "Me and Steve can share."
"No need to," David said. "There's plenty. Honest." He gave a can to Audrey, a can to Tom, and a can to Johnny. Johnny turned his over twice in his hand, as if trying to make sure it was real, before pulling off the wrapper, taking the key off the back, and inserting it in the tab of metal at the end of the can. He opened it. As soon as he smelled the fish, he was savagely hungry. If anyone had told him he would ever have such a reaction to a lousy can of sardines, he would have laughed. Something tapped him on the shoulder. It was Mary holding out the box of crackers. She looked almost ecstatic. Fish oil ran down from the corner of her mouth to her chin in a shiny little runnel.
"Go on," she said. "They're wonderful on crackers. Really."
"Yep," Cynthia said cheerfully. "Everything tastes better when it shits on a Ritz. That's what I always say." Johnny accepted the box, looked in, and saw there was only a single cylinder of wax paper left, half full. He took three of the round, dark, orange crackers. His growling stomach protested this forbearance, and he found himself unable to keep from taking three more before passing the box to Billingsley. Their eyes met for a moment, and he heard the old man saying not even Houdini could have done it that way, because of the head. And of course there was the phone, three transmission bars showing when it had been in the kid's hands, none at all when he had held it in his own.
"This settles it once and for all," Cynthia said, her mouth full. She sounded the way Mary looked. "Food is way better than sex."
Johnny looked at David. He was sitting on one arm of his father's chair, eating. Ralph's can of sardines sat in his lap, unopened, as the man continued to look out over the rows of empty seats. David took a couple of sardines from his own can, laid them carefully on a cracker, and gave them to his dad, who began to chew mechanically, doing it as if his only goal was to clear his mouth again. Seeing the boy's expression of attentive love made Johnny uncomfortable, as if he were violating David's privacy. He looked away and saw the box of crackers on the floor. Everyone was busy eating, and no one paid Johnny any particular attention when he picked up the box and looked into it. It had gone all the way around the group. Everyone had at least half a dozen crackers. Billingsley might have taken even more. The old goat was really cramming them in. But that cylinder of waxed paper was still in there,
and Johnny could have sworn that it was still half full, that the number of crackers in it had not changed at all. 4.